Bethel, the surrounding villages, there is on average one rape or child sexual abuse case reported every other day.
A plea in Congress for more help for Alaska victims of sexual assault. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 10th. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, McGrath loses most of its wildland firefighters to state budget cuts.
To manage an area that's 88 million acres large from the other side of the Alaska Range makes no sense at all.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood this summer. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
In Washington, D.C. this afternoon, the Senate Indian Affairs Committee heard pleas for better treatment of crime victims in Native communities. Jared Godfrey, chairman of Alaska's Violent Crime Compensation Board, cited a few of the state's grim statistics.
In Bethel, the surrounding villages, there is on average one rape or child sexual abuse case reported every other day.
Godfrey says a victim in a village might be flown to a hospital, sometimes as far as Anchorage, for evidence collection with no advocate. Worse, Godfrey says, often there's no investigation, and family members tell young victims to keep quiet.
If they don't feel that what happened to them is serious and it was very bad and somebody cares, our opportunity to restore them emotionally, spiritually, and mentally probably passes. But beyond that, they also are more likely to perpetuate that as they grow older.
Godfrey spent part of his childhood in Bethel when his father worked as a state trooper there. He says he recalls third and fourth grade friends casually discussing abuse and which kids had been victimized. His testimony and the stories told from other states stunned Senator Heidi Heitkamp, a North Dakota Democrat.
Who could sit in this room and not be horrified? One out of almost every three children between the ages of 11 and 13 in middle school tested positive for a sexually transmitted disease on Fort Peck. In what world aren't we are horrified? Your testimony, Mr. Godfrey, I'm horrified. I'm horrified by all of this.
Heitkamp and Senator Lisa Murkowski pushed a bill through the Senate last week to establish a national commission on Native children. It is awaiting action in the House. Godfrey says the single biggest help would be money for sexual assault response teams. As he sees it, they'd fly to a community right after a report to both help the victim and start the investigation. He also advocates for abuse prevention education in schools, an idea the Alaska legislature is wrestling with. Murkowski says leaving the decision to each school district isn't a solution.
Some of our small communities where our school boards are making these decisions, it may be that some of those school board members are part of our problem and they don't want to see these things, the prevention education included in the schools.
Murkowski says hearings like this one occur every few years in the committee, and she cautioned against going numb to the statistics. After holding the bill for 3 weeks, the Senate Finance Committee has unveiled a new version of the Alaska Safe Children's Act, known nationally as Aaron's Law. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports that some controversial riders have been removed.
When lawmakers last saw the Alaska Safe Children's Act, it was in a mutant form. In a push by MATSU Republicans, the sexual abuse prevention bill had grown from 3 pages to 12, and it had picked up sections that banned schools from contracting with Planned Parenthood and that let students opt out of standardized testing. Most troublesome to the bill's sponsors, it gutted the original legislation by making the establishment of sexual abuse prevention programs optional. The substitute offered by the Senate Finance Committee kept the length of the last iteration. But as Soldotna Republican Peter Michicki explained, the content hewed much closer to the original bill.
A lot of the changes in here are related to the initial bill, like the task force. Some of it added extra space, but doesn't change the effectiveness of, you know, the Aaron and Bree Law sections.
The new version requires adults who volunteer with children for at least 4 hours a week to be mandatory reporters. And it creates a task force to come up with age-appropriate curricula for different grades. The bill gives that task force until 2017 to develop the program before it becomes compulsory for schools. Senator Anna McKinnon, an Eagle River Republican, gave the reason for the task force.
There is no intention by myself or anyone that I've been speaking with to try to delay anything, but only try to perfect or at least improve the outcomes of safety for kids in our schools.
The Senate Finance Committee also stripped many of the additions that were not germane to the original bill. MATSU Republican Mike Dunleavy was responsible for some of those riders, with the idea of turning the Alaska Safe Children's Act into an omnibus parental rights bill. He asked McKinnon if his changes had been removed.
Just a quick clarification, the section on parental rights is totally out of this, correct?
Senator Dunleavy, that's not correct. It depends on perspective.
McKinnon then went on to say that, yes, the more controversial components had been taken out. When the committee took testimony on the bill later in the day, most members of the public expressed support for their actions. A box of tissues sat next to the microphone, and person after person came up and told their own stories of abuse. Butch Moore spoke of his daughter, Bree Moore, the namesake of the dating violence section of the bill. Bree was murdered last year, and her boyfriend was charged. Butch Moore said it's hard for him to argue about different kinds of parental rights when his daughter is dead.
Our parental rights have been taken away and stripped away from us. Our parental rights have been violated more than anyone's.
At a press conference, Governor Bill Walker also applauded the changes, adding that it bodes well for the legislature concluding its special session and reaching a deal on the budget in the coming days. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Governor Bill Walker will take a modest step towards streamlining state government by combining two divisions within the State Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Walker, at a press conference today, announced the Employment Security Division would be combined with the Division of Business Partnerships. The combined agency will be the Division of Employment and Training Services. The projected savings of the consolidation is $600,000. Walker says that won't balance the budget, but it's a start. He credits Labor Commissioner Heidi Drygass for coming up with the plan and says other consolidations are likely. Drygass also is declaring Alaska a zone of underemployment that will allow an employment preference for Alaskans on state public works contracts. The declaration requires that Alaska residents be given a 90% employment preference. Governor Bill Walker likely has the authority to expand Medicaid without legislative approval, according to two legal opinions written last month. One opinion from the legislature's Legal Services Department says the state's health department can cooperate with the federal government and accept money for things like Medicaid. The opinion also points out it is probably unconstitutional for lawmakers to include a line in the budget blocking Governor Walker from receiving Medicaid expansion funds. That's because a section of the state constitution says bills for appropriation shall be confined to appropriations. The memo was written in response to a question from House Minority Leader Chris Tuck. In a separate opinion, the state law department makes a similar argument. In an email, a spokesperson for the governor says Walker will evaluate whether to expand Medicaid on his own after the legislative session. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, residents of Nikiski push for more police in the community.
We are on the cusp of having a dramatic economic change in our community, and we can either be prepared if it does come or not be prepared.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A case of measles in Fairbanks is the first confirmed occurrence of the highly contagious viral infection in the state in 15 years. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services says a man who flew from Mongolia to Fairbanks on May 31st to work at the University of Alaska Fairbanks tested positive for the virus. He was at the university and numerous other locations around the city, including several stores, before he knew he had measles. The man was contagious through June 7th in Fairbanks. State of Alaska epidemiologist Dr. Joe McLaughlin suspects the man contracted measles in Mongolia, where there's a large ongoing outbreak of the disease that causes a telltale rash, fever, runny nose, red eyes, and in rare cases can lead to deadly pneumonia or encephalitis.
The big question is, what should people in Fairbanks be doing?
Dr. McLaughlin says that depends on a few things. He says people born before 1957 are likely immune to measles because they were exposed to the actual virus prior to widespread immunization. He says many born after that date were likely immunized as children, protection that lasts a lifetime, but otherwise.
If you're unvaccinated or undervaccinated, or you're not sure, our recommendation is to go to your healthcare provider and make sure you get vaccinated.
McLaughlin says measles spreads easily through the air and respiratory secretions, even up to 2 hours after an infected person has been in a room.
Measles is one of the most contagious pathogens known. About 90% of people who are exposed to measles who have not been vaccinated or have not had the infection in the past will get infected.
McLaughlin says symptoms typically take a week to 3 weeks to appear after exposure. He adds the virus can spread from an infected person 4 days before the rash starts and 4 days after it ends. The state reports the man who traveled to Fairbanks with measles was on a flight from Seattle that stopped in Seattle, but not Anchorage. Federal officials are contacting people who may have been exposed on airlines outside of Alaska. Firefighting efforts are winding down on two wildfires in southwest Alaska. The 14,800-acre Whitefish Lake fire was contained as of Monday. At just more than 25,000 acres, the Bogus Creek fire was the largest yet this year and was demobilized Tuesday. The state's firefighting assets that responded to these fires were based out of McGrath, the station that covers the nearly 90 million acres of southwest Alaska. Next month, McGrath will lose the majority of its firefighting staff due to state budget cuts. KDLG's Hannah Colton looks at what that will mean for firefighting in southwest Alaska and also for the future of a small town like McGrath.
In early July, the McGrath station will lose 16 of its 22 positions. The six left on site will be a fire manager, two radio dispatchers, and three maintenance staff. That will be a skeleton crew for what has long been the state's forward operating base for fighting wildland fires in southwest Alaska. But Division of Forestry spokesperson Tim Mowry says that crew will be able to ramp things up when necessary.
Say it's hot and dry and, you know, out near McGrath and, you know, there's high fire danger. We could request a load or two loads of smoke jumpers to fly out there and just be stationed in McGrath so that if and when something does happen, they're there and can respond.
Mowry says the same will be done for aircraft, which would come from Palmer, Kenai, or Fairbanks. He says the DNR and forestry do this kind of shuffling around all the time, and the state hopes it will save money in this era of smaller budgets and shrinking services. Others are skeptical.
Well, I think that it's very short-sighted, to say the least.
That's McGrath Mayor Dustin Parker, who isn't sure the firefighting readiness will be what Southwest Alaskans deserve.
To manage an area that's 88 million acres large from the other side of the Alaska Range makes no sense at all. When a fire occurs, a wildfire occurs, and you have to mobilize a force from an hour and a half away either direction, there's a real opportunity for loss of life, loss of property, loss of infrastructure.
But there's another side of this story for Mayor Parker and the rest of McGrath's 350 year-round residents.
It's unfortunate from an economic standpoint for the little community and the surrounding villages in the Upper Kuskokwim region, because a lot of people rely on the ability to work for the Department of Natural Resources.
In what once was a thriving interior hub town, McGrath's residents have watched one agency after another pack up and leave. First the Air Force Base, the FAA, the National Weather Service, and most recently Fish and Wildlife Service with their Anoka Wildlife Refuge offices. With the coming loss of the 16 state employees and the money and contracts that came with them, some residents wonder how their town will survive. Craig Losby, a longtime resident, has been outspoken since the DNR cuts were announced.
You know, they were a huge user of the infrastructure here. The electrical grid, the sewer, the water system, everything was geared to all these other agencies that were here. And then they leave, and the burden of sustaining the whole thing then falls on the people remaining.
Losby feels the state has turned mostly a blind eye and deaf ear to their complaints.
The most frustrating thing is nobody listens. You know, we spend a lot of time and money and energy contacting our state legislators, the governor, and everybody else, and nobody has done anything for us.
July 1st will come and go, and six of 22 Southwest Alaska firefighting positions will be left in McGrath. Reporting in Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Marijuana is now subject to the same rules limiting secondhand smoke from cigarettes in Alaska's largest city. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, the move was a blow for legalization advocates in Anchorage, and many questions remain.
A vote by the Anchorage Assembly modified rules already on the books that limit cigarette smoke, which now include marijuana. Anchorage already passed a measure banning public consumption, and the new vote extends restrictions to more buildings and businesses. Assemblymember Paul Honeman says the ordinance asks users to take on a measure of courtesy.
I think this becomes a conundrum for people who are living in multi-unit apartment buildings, but in a single-family home, or perhaps maybe there's a duplex and both neighbors are users of marijuana and they don't object to it. I don't think that's going to impact or affect anyone.
A person lighting up too close to an entryway or inside a hotel room where smoking is banned can be written a $100 ticket. Assembly members like Honeman say that in the last few months, they've gotten a lot more complaints from constituents about marijuana smoke seeping through apartments, creating annoyances and serious problems for some tenants.
In one particular case, this gentleman told me he had cancer. He was both living on Social Security disability, which was limiting his available options to rent. And then secondly, he was having some medical problems that were being worsened. This particular ordinance may not address individual apartments, but clearly if your smoke is getting from your apartment to a neighboring apartment, this ordinance may in fact apply to that.
The other major driver behind the ordinance passing 9-1 is a tenant dispute involving an existing marijuana business. Potluck Events, a marijuana-friendly events company in downtown Anchorage, exists in a bit of a legal gray zone as the state develops regulations for private clubs, and some have criticized the company for jumping the gun. Much of the public testimony on the matter came from Potluck supporters who say the space fills a need for a safe place to consume marijuana. It is, however, located underneath a church and right next door to Beacon Hill, a daycare center for foster children. Cindy Adamson works at Beacon and says the frequent cannabis odor creates problems for many of the families they work with.
When you have people that are addicts and they are trying to clean up their life and get it put back together, a particular drug of choice, which could be marijuana, could be their trigger. And if they smell it, that can trigger them to want to go and try and do it. And then that just kind of fails them in their case plan to try and get their children back.
Adamson says the potluck owners have been good neighbors, but the shared building is a bad fit for the different tenant groups involved. It's not clear if potluck will have to close down shop because of the new measure. The secondhand smoke language bans smoking lighted tobacco or marijuana, but whether that applies to consumption methods like vaping or dabbing, which don't involve a flame exactly, remains to be seen. The municipality expects smoking marijuana indoors to eventually be handled by a conditional use permit the state sets up down the line. Bruce Schulte of the Campaign for Responsible Cannabis Legislation says that while the Anchorage measure is broad, it's understandable.
The real takeaway from tonight, I think, is that, you know, folks really do need to just kind of sit back and wait until the state finishes the mandated regulatory process in November and then create business models.
The real loser, Schulte says, are the business owners who now have 90 days to update their no smoking signs to include marijuana alongside cigarettes. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
More property crime and the potential for hundreds of new residents in the coming years has the unincorporated area of Nikiski looking for more law enforcement. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, the area is underserved by the Alaska State Troopers and community members want action.
One of the things that makes Nikiski so attractive to the people who live here is the same thing that makes it pretty attractive for petty criminals. Quiet, secluded neighborhoods with no cops and the space to be more or less left alone to do as you please. But that's not really working for everyone anymore. It really hasn't been working for a while.
So it seems to be the same conversation that we had back in 2004, and here we are again.
That's Ann Krogsing. She runs a construction business with her husband, and she says the property crime has gotten so bad that when some gas was siphoned from one of their tanks recently, they didn't even bother calling it in. And she doesn't think the multi-billion dollar Alaska LNG project coming to town is going to help matters.
And we are on the cusp of having a dramatic economic change in our community. And we can either be prepared if it does come or not be prepared. We can either be proactive or will be reactive.
Krogsing was one of more than 100 residents who came to a recent meeting to find out more about a proposed law enforcement service area. Since Nikiski isn't a city, the services it does get through the Kenai Peninsula Borough, like fire response and recreation, are all approved on local ballots and paid for through local taxes. Having that local control is a big selling point, as people aren't real satisfied with the Alaska State Troopers' ability to respond to calls from their post in Soldotna, 30 minutes away. But a dedicated police force isn't the answer for everyone. Local militia members, like Ray Southwell, think they should be able to take care of themselves.
I'm in the process of developing the Deacons for Defense, and have called upon militia members in our community to join my efforts to expose the drug dealers and disrupt their money-making schemes that destroys communities.
Most residents do point to drug use as the main culprit behind all the property theft, and it's those layers of related crimes that make people think a permanent police presence is the best answer. But it will be up to the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly to decide if the question of creating a new law enforcement service area will go on the ballot this fall. And if it does, the final decision will be up to the residents in Nikiski. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Four people are safe after their fishing tender sank off Cape Fairweather early this morning. A helicopter from Air Station Sitka hoisted the crew of the 80-foot tender just as the vessel rolled and sank in 6-foot seas near Lituya Bay. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The Kuprianov was en route from Petersburg to Bristol Bay to tender salmon when it ran into trouble at about 3:45 a.m., in an area known as the Fairweather Grounds, about 110 miles northwest of Sitka. Chris Stokler was the pilot of the Air Station Sitka rescue helicopter. He says the Kuprianov was already partially submerged by the time he arrived. The rear deck or port quarter was already awash. The four members of the Kuprianov's crew were in the bow wearing their survival suits. Their life raft was deployed at the stern. Stokler says he instructed the crew to abandon ship.
One guy jumped onto the raft. The others had to swim out to the raft. We put Jason down to the water, and he helped three people get into the raft.
That's Jason Yelvington, the helicopter crew's rescue swimmer. Stokler says the four hoists took about 20 minutes, which is all the time the Kuprianov had left.
Last basket pickup, the boat sank and took the raft with it.
Rescue swimmer Yelvington says in a situation like this, where sinking is imminent, he prefers to do his work in the water rather than on the distressed boat.
Whether it sinks or not, there are just a lot of hazards for them to hit their head, cause bigger injury trying to move around. I've got fins on usually, taking those off to get onto the boat and help them. It's just usually a lot easier of an evolution for us if everybody's in the raft in one area that I can get to and swim them from there.
Yelvington says there was a lot of diesel fuel in the water, and breathing the fumes made the work harder. He appreciated the fact that the crew members of the Kuprianov were all functioning well under trying circumstances. He says it's often not until everyone's safely aboard the helicopter that they're hit by what's just happened.
Not an opportunity for a lot of conversation, so I think they get to go through a lot of the interior stuff that happens kind of on the way back and get a chance to calm down especially. So I think that could be helpful to somebody to kind of reflect on what just happened.
A Good Samaritan vessel, a ship, according to co-pilot Ben Neal, also responded to the Kuprianov's mayday, but notified the Coast Guard that it would have been difficult to recover survivors from the water had that been necessary. Nevertheless, the Good Samaritan would have been useful if something had gone wrong. But Neal says a lot went right, thanks to the advanced preparation of the Kuprianov crew before they set out across the Gulf.
They had actually done a drill the day before where they got their Gumby suits out and inspected their equipment. And that was probably critical in how prepared they were today. They really did have things well organized. They were pretty calm, and they called for help at the right time.
All the survivors and rescue swimmer Yelvington were checked out by medical personnel once they returned to Sitka. Other than their exposure to diesel fumes, all were released without injury. The Coast Guard Marine Safety Detachment is investigating the cause of the Kuprianov's flooding. Neal says the vessel had been out of service for roughly 20 years prior to making this voyage. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.